MTV makes me want to smoke crack. It's time for the Saftacast. I'm your host, Scott C. Hey, folks, how you doing? Are you doing good? I'm doing a lot better than I was last week, I'll tell you that, when we recorded that promo. To be honest, I don't even remember recording that promo. Seriously, I barely remember it. But I do remember our interview for today and our guest, and let's get to that in just a moment. First, you know, as we go through the end of the year here, there's not much time left. We got a couple more episodes, and we'll talk about our holiday hiatus, quote unquote. Later on, in a week or two, we'll tell you all about that, what's going to happen around it. Because right now, we're scheduled to come up on Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve, and yeah, that ain't happening. Sorry. But in 2015, when we come back, you have a chance as well to be a part of the SunTrust Academy for the Arts. There are spots open right now for residency in beginning in February 2015 to get in on this action, to apply for it, to be a part of this amazing opportunity to be part of the largest or one of the largest writer and artist communities in all of Appalachia. Go to sundresspublications.com/SAFTA, S-A-F-T-A, and look for the button that says apply. There you can read all of the information, you can download the forms and everything. It is something you want to be a part of. Seriously, if you're a writer or a visual artist or a video, whatever you may be, if you are involved in the arts, consider being a part of this. And if you know somebody in the arts, maybe you yourself are not artistically inclined, but you know somebody who is a playwright, an actor, a musician, a visual artist, whatever it may be, they're just involved in the fine arts, tell them to go to sundresspublications.com/SAFTA and click on apply. Today's interview is a good one. It's with Noe Onatai, good man out of Missouri. What is it with us in Missouri writers? This is like our third Missouri writer. I don't know. There's like some weird connection, symbiotic connection between us and Missouri on this program. I don't know. But it doesn't matter to me because our guest is really cool. And we had a great conversation about life in Thailand. Who knew that 7-Elevens in Thailand were so cool? I didn't. But we get into that as well as talking about his favorite TV show and much more on today's program. It is one not to be missed. Buckle in, settle down, because it's a good one. But first, have a taste of the theme song, won't you? Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing great. How are you? I'm surprised it's working.
Oh, it works. You got to trust in the technology, I guess.
So, my Skype has been kind of not on and off for the past few months, so I wasn't so sure this time.
Oh, it's working now. We'll just hope it keeps working. So let me start this off with the way I start off all our interviews, with the burning question that is on everyone's mind right now.
Right.
Ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
Where have all the flowers gone?
Where have all the flowers gone? Well, if you live in the Midwest like I do, they've all gone and died because of the early taste of winter that we're having right now.
The polar vortex.
Yes, the polar vortex.
Fair enough answer, though. Flowers are dead and gone.
I guess winter makes me very literal-minded. Must be the stark landscapes and utter depression of the season.
Yeah, you're in Missouri.
Yes, I am in Missouri, which means I don't have it as bad as I could have it, but I'm really sensitive to, basically after daylight savings, I become a huge recluse.
How so?
Well, this might be the only human interaction I have all day, and it's mediated through a computer. I don't know, something about the quality of light and the lack of light and the cold weather. Yesterday I got back from work, lay in bed under three layers of blankets in the dark, and just did nothing for an hour, had no will to get up and turn on a light, to heat up leftovers, to do anything, really.
Do you have what's called seasonal affective disorder? SAD?
You know, I'd like to think I do, but it's never been diagnosed.
I don't know what the cure for that is either. Like, how do you treat that?
I hear if you buy yourself fresh flowers and string up lights, that should help with things. But I haven't quite found anything that works for me. Even drinking doesn't work anymore. Drinking does not bring me joy in winter.
I can't even drink booze to kill the pain.
Right, because who wants a cold drink? Unless it's like a hot cider, there's just no joy in even drinking in the winter.
You only drink cold because you have to. What is your favorite drink?
What is my favorite drink? I'm very much still a college boy at heart. I say that with full disclosure that I'm rather young. I might be one of the younger people you've had on your show. In fact, are we on right now?
Yeah.
Okay, we're on right now. Great. Yeah. Full disclosure, I'm one of the younger people you may have interviewed before. I'm very much a college boy at heart, so I still drink sometimes to get drunk. Okay, maybe many times to get drunk. So I'm not any sort of liquor snob or wine snob or beer snob. I will drink your generic beers. I will drink your generic liquors. I'm not good with dark liquor.
Like whiskey and bourbon?
Right. My housemate, he has a small bourbon collection, and I hate it. I can't stand it. So I'm much more, I guess, a vodka, anything kind of guy.
Vodka, gin type of thing?
Actually, not gin. So I guess I am somewhat selective. Gin just makes me feel like I'm drinking molten deodorant.
What about tequila?
Tequila. I mean, if it's there, I'll have it.
Sure, why not? You know, hand it down.
I don't go up to the bar and order tequila very often, but every now and then someone will suggest tequila shots, and I won't say no.
But if I had my choice, no.
Well, I guess I would still have a choice, but in that case, I'd say yes.
What about rum? Because rum can come two ways. It can come like the spiced rum, darker caramel color, or it can come like Bacardi and be white, clear.
I'm actually fine with both kinds of rum. I think it's because it's sweet.
And depending what you mix it with.
Yes. On its own, it has a sweetness that's more palatable to me, I guess.
Simple tip from my college days, don't mix rum and Pepsi.
Oh, no?
Rum and Coke works fine, but rum and Pepsi don't go together for some reason.
Well, I'm not quite a Pepsi guy anyways, so...
So now, a question for you, moving away from booze, kind of, sort of. How did you come to wind up in Missouri? You're the third, at least, the third guest we've had that's from Missouri.
Oh, really? Who else have you had from out here?
Dan Crocker, we had him, and Mary Stone.
Okay. Well, I grew up about 4.5 hours north. I'm from right outside Chicago, and then I went to school in Chicago. But after my undergrad, I did a stint in Bangkok and ended up at an MFA program out here and have stuck around ever since.
So you're not originally from Thailand?
I am originally from Thailand. I was born in Bangkok, but I left when I was 4 and have grown up outside of Chicago ever since.
Have you been back to Thailand that much outside of that one trip?
When I was younger, not often, but once I was in my undergrad, I think I went almost every other year. And then right after my undergrad, I actually worked in Thailand for about, I shouldn't say I worked, I received a research grant to live in Bangkok for almost 2 years after my undergrad.
What was it like going back the first time?
Going back the first time? You mean the first time?
Yeah, the first return trip. Because you say you left when you were 4. Mm-hmm. So your memories of that childhood must be very vague and minimal. So what was it like going back for the first time as if you had never been there before?
You know, I think growing up in the American Midwest and in the suburbs and kind of always knowing I had this alternate childhood and background, I think I tended to exoticize Thailand. I would go to restaurants, Thai restaurants in, here in the States, and look at the glossy pictures in the menus and in the tourist brochures. And, they always show the ancient places, the temples, the murals, the classical theater. And I think that really, I mean, that gave me an interest in sort of Thai classical art that I feel not many people of my generation who grew up in Thailand actually have. But I can't say I remember what my expectations were that first trip back. I think my first trip back was Not until I was in the second or third grade. I can't say I remember too much from that period. And then once I returned when I was older, I was, you know, a little bit more mature and able to modify those expectations of this exotic historical city.
And it becomes something different then.
Well, excuse me, I'm a little stuffed up because of this polar vortex.
You and me both. If I cough during this, I apologize in advance.
Sam, we should actually time ourselves so we have a period where we just both turn and cough at the same time.
We'll sync our lungs together.
Save our listeners the static in the background. I would say my experience of Thailand has been tempered by actually living there. And, you know, I do like the lifestyle there. I like the availability of food. I like the demeanor of the society for the most part. But it's been tempered by the realities of Thai politics, even city infrastructure, getting from place to place, terrible traffic, that sort of thing, pollution. So I don't have this fantasy city in my mind anymore.
It's like any other city in the world, basically, in some respects.
In some respects, yeah. Like, it definitely has the woes of any big urban center, exacerbated by somewhat turbulent politics. But that said, Bangkok is still a city that I love to go to be in.
You mentioned there's a different lifestyle. What's the difference?
Well, you know, after coming back from Bangkok, I moved almost immediately to suburban St. Louis. The biggest change for me was the eating culture. In Thailand, and Thai food has become famous the world over. It has become a huge, I don't want to say a fad, but it has become more well-known now than it was when I was growing up.
Heck, I'm in South Florida, and there's a Thai restaurant right down the street from me.
Right, you're lucky then. But when I came back, you know, when I lived in Thailand, I could walk out of my apartment, and there was just food everywhere. Inexpensive, very good. I could eat at all times of the day. Good portions, freshly made. But when I moved to, when I started my MFA, and I lived in a dorm, and then I keep weird hours, if I missed eating at the cafeteria, there was really not a lot of options for if I wanted good, fresh food, you know, after hours. I couldn't eat after 8 p.m. The easiest and cheapest meal to have would be fast food. That was the only alternative if I wanted something quick, easy, and relatively inexpensive.
It's not like in Bangkok where you could walk down the street and there's five vendors right there.
Right, there's just five vendors, and they're making soup or rice or noodles. So I'm actually getting a savory meal with fresh ingredients, and I'm spending a relatively small amount of money for it. There was a time when I really gained a lot of weight when I first came back to the U.S. where, you know, I missed meals at the cafeteria, which sometimes I feel is just glorified fast food anyways. Really only having, you know, McDonald's down the street if I wanted something cheap and easy.
No, I can see that. Bourdain talks about this, Anthony Bourdain talks about it a lot, that the best food in the world is street food.
Mm-hmm. And I have friends that say, oh, I could never eat the street food. I mean, you will probably get sick once or twice, not necessarily because the food is unhygienic, but because you're not used to the bacteria in the area. But once you get used to it, it really is the best food in the world.
And like you said, cheap as shit, basically.
Basically, yeah, I could eat, you know, $20, I could eat lunch for a week. It was only about $1.50, $2 for lunch. Well, if you're eating from the street, now I had people visit me in Bangkok and say, so where should we eat? What restaurants do you recommend? And I'd say, I just shrug my shoulders and say, I live here, but I never eat at restaurants. I just eat off the street.
There's a guy, he's down the two buildings down, and he has a cart.
Yeah, and that's really what I would say. I say I go to that cart, you know, once or twice a week.
It becomes almost like drug dealing then. I know this guy. He's got the best soup on the street, all right? Now you go to him, you tell him my name, and he'll hook you up, you know.
Well, they did say that in some of those soups in the old days, they would put marijuana leaves into the broth, more for flavor than for any pharmaceutical effect.
I never thought about that. Marijuana as a seasoning.
This is definitely before my time, though. I've just read about this. I don't think it really happens anymore. It's not legal anymore, so I don't think it's going on.
Yeah, we're not advocating anything illegal here, but that's something I just never thought of.
And I wonder if there's any literature or brochures like the pro-marijuana movement saying you can also use hemp as seasoning.
Well, I'm sure there's a hemp cookbook, out in Colorado.
Beyond brownies.
Though I think I knew someone who was telling me he was cooking with, ooh, gee, am I outing someone right now? I had an acquaintance that mentioned cooking with hemp. I don't remember quite what it was, but it was not a brownie.
All right, so eating in Bangkok, and so the differences, are there any other lifestyle differences? Is it like a faster pace in Thailand or a slower pace than America?
The caveat with the story is that I was living under a research grant where I didn't exactly have a 9-to-5. I was making my own schedule. I like to call it an extended writer's retreat. So I can say the pace of my life was definitely slower just because of that. That said, though, one of the key words for Thai society is sabai, and it means easy or convenient or comfortable. And I think for a large part, it's even in a hectic city like Bangkok, it's still fairly, it holds fairly well. People do tend to, they don't want to make big deals out of things. They don't want to rush necessarily.
So it is a little more laid back.
But... I would say so. And with the caveat, like I said, that my experience might have been colored by the fact that the very circumstances of my life, I had the luxury of being laid back.
What were you there for researching?
Well, I received a grant through the Fulbright program in languages and literature. My proposal was actually to go there and do translations of some classical Thai poetry.
But it felt like with the pause there was a but coming.
I was wondering if I was going to include the but. I would say that when I went, and to this day I still feel like someone from the Department of State who administers the Fulbright program is going to drop out of the sky if I make these confessions publicly. I was very green when I went. I just graduated from my undergrad. I'd never really undertaken a large writing project before, like a really sustained project where writing was my lifestyle. And though I'd written before, I hadn't really written much before, maybe more than the average person, but I was a little in over my head when push came to shove. I'd gone planning on finishing, quite a bit of this particular piece of literature, and really after a year only finished one chunk of it that I'm still working on today.
So it ended up being, I know exactly what you're talking about, basically. You bit off a bit more than you could chew.
Yes, definitely. That's not to say, for those Department of State people that are listening to this right now, that's not to say that I didn't get work done. It wasn't the work that I planned on doing, and it was a great, I hate to say this, but a great learning experience or a growing experience to actually establish this writing goal for myself and to flounder through it. I think to be a serious writer, you actually need to have a writing lifestyle.
Do you need to live a life to be a writer?
I think you do. Because where would your material come from?
It's just, I hear things like, oh, you have to have a bad childhood in order to be a writer. And things like that. Or you can't really be a writer until you've drank cappuccino at a Parisian cafe at 2 a.m.
I mean, neither of those are true. I tell my students that, I make them write personal narratives. And these are ESL students. They're not creative writing students at all. They're just non-native English language learners. I tell them, you all have something to write about. Anyone can turn an interesting story from the mundane details of their lives. It's just a matter of how you do it, a matter of craft, I guess.
A matter of lying.
Yes, a matter of lying.
it's all in how you tell the lie.
Exactly.
I'm going right now, same thing right now with my students. We're doing personal narratives.
Okay.
And so they're learning a little bit about that aspect of you do have to lie to a degree.
Now, is this English comp that you're teaching?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're actually teaching native English speakers. The only difference is that I'm teaching non-native English.
Yeah, for the most part, they're non-ESL. There right. are a few, but because we have a lot of, in my school, we have a lot of people coming from the Caribbean and such.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a lot of non-native speakers. But, like you said, everybody's got a cool story.
Right.
So now I'm curious, what's when you give your students the assignment, what's the assignment for their personal narrative? Is there any specialty? Are you aiming for, like, tell a story of a significant moment in your childhood?
We read a few personal narratives that I brought in, and then I took a day and I said, you have free rein. You can write about anything you want from your life, anything you want. And those were the only instructions I gave. As long as it would not get me in trouble, because I actually had them upload their writing onto a blog online. It's available for anyone to read, and I was actually blown away by the results. Even my lower level learners, they really blew me away, and I really think that goes to show that telling stories is such an innate thing to do as humans.
It's where the first writing comes from.
Right, and the impulse to tell the story. I didn't really have to talk much about it. Yeah, I took a day and talked about structure. I talked about rising action and how there should be some sort of climax. You should have, you know, a memorable character, even if it's just the narrator. I said that, you know, the best story should have a denouement, some kind of reflection or conclusion. And that was really all I gave them. And I was blown away by the results.
Yes, humans were... Most of our life is built upon personal narratives and telling people, this is my experience today at the bus stop.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very easy form to slip into.
Yes.
So you give them basic story construction and then just let them go at it.
Yes. And it worked out much better than I really had hoped for.
Like, what were some of the things they were talking about? Do you remember any good ones that blew you away?
Yes, yes. One of my boys who is speaking wise, he's kind of a lower level speaker. On a sentence level, his English is still, you know, it's still a little bit gnarled. The syntax is out of order. But I read his piece. He talked about his grandparents. Am I violating FERPA laws right now by talking about this?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Well, you're not revealing any personal details. You're not naming this student.
This could be anyone.
This could be anyone. And you said that the blog was publicly verifiable.
Yes.
Publicly accessible.
Yes.
So you're just retelling a blog post.
Okay. Yes, yes, yes. So this boy talked about his grandparents. And in 1 year, both grandmother and grandfather passed away. Grandmother actually got sick first. And from what I understand, grandfather worried himself sick and ended up having a stroke and passing away before grandmother. Grandmother recovered but was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and for the last few months of her life lived with this student and his family until one day the student's mother, the boy's mother, decided to take grandma back to grandma's house. The house where she'd grown up in, where she had spent most of her married life. And miraculously, after forgetting most details of her life, when she went back to that house for the first time in, you know, since she had been hospitalized and been diagnosed, she regained her memories. She remembered the house. She sort of remembered who she was by being at that house. And according to the narrative, she ended up passing away that same day after regaining her memories in the same couch where her husband had passed away. And I was blown away by this story, number one, just because the subject matter is moving on its own. The way that this boy, who had trouble fashioning sentences, the way that he structured the story so that there was a clear rising action, and then that sort of climactic moment. He knew not to reveal it in the beginning or to place it right at the end or in the middle. So even if his sentence structure was not the most clear, the arc of the story itself was the product of someone who really thought about how to tell this event. That really blew me away, and he's always been kind of a lower proficiency student in my class.
Sometimes your students surprise you.
Not always in good ways, but in this case, I was very happy with the way this project turned out.
Yeah, just when I think I've seen, heard, dealt with it all, I'll get an email once a semester that I just am flabbergasted by. Like, I do not know how to respond to this. I've taught thousands of students, and you're the first person who's ever brought up this issue to me.
Well, and you teach actual native speakers. Imagine teaching people who come from completely different academic backgrounds or academic cultures, really. And you get a lot of you get a lot of strange requests.
I know what you're talking about there, but I also learned, I hate this cliche statement, I learn from my students. But I will say that I have sometimes, for example, I did not know anything about Creole French.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'm talking to a couple Haitian students of mine in the past, they said, I pointed out some thoughts on their papers, and they said, you know, doctor, in Creole French, we use a lot of passive voice, a lot of past tense in there. And so to transition to English, that blew my mind. That helped me to explain a lot of an ESL issue I was having. I was like, oh, that makes sense.
Okay.
Ah, okay. So now when I'm looking at it and I know the speaker is Haitian descent, I look at it and go, I'm less, you know, harsh on it by going, ah, I know what this is.
That does come in handy. I feel the same way sometimes about my Japanese students, though their grammar tends to be excellent. They still have the bad habit of inverting the syntax. My Spanish speakers tend to invert their syntax a lot.
Do you have a lot of Japanese students in Missouri?
You know, the school I teach at, we have so many international students from all over the place, especially in the ESL program. I think right now I'm teaching Venezuelans in the same class as French, as Japanese. I have a few Chinese students in the same class. Some Thai students are sitting in on the class. So it really is a mixed bag.
That's got to be a big challenge then, with so many different linguistic structures to deal with.
Yeah, I really have to say that we, in this program, we kind of have to pick up a lot of stuff. We have to really brush ourselves up on the different backgrounds. I have Mongolian students. I never thought I'd once meet people from Mongolia, but there's actually a large group of them in this particular program.
Wow. Do they surprise you still?
They do. They do. This assignment, I really thought that, you know, I tried not to have too many expectations. I tried to tap into their interest in social media by creating the blog for them to upload their stories with photos if they'd like, and, you know, having those Facebook, Twitter links so that they could share directly with their family and friends. And I really think they engaged in the project a lot more because of that social media aspect. And some of their stories just blew me away, especially from those, like I was saying, those lower level students. If they were having a hard time communicating on a sentence level, they knew exactly what they were doing in sort of a bigger picture, structuring the narrative kind of way.
That's big stuff. It's one thing to know the structure of a sentence. It's another thing to have the abstract concepts like denouement and falling action down in their head.
And knowing to put the climax here, the most exciting or the most suspenseful piece or a part of the story, knowing exactly where to place it and knowing how to lead into it. I mean, I still can't do that.
I sometimes really, when I'm writing, I have no idea what I'm doing. I just know, okay, this is how you tell the story, but I really don't know what I'm doing.
This is why I translate a lot.
Yeah, what's the mindset of translation? I don't do much translation work, so how does that operate in your mind? Does it work like that, where you go in like, I really have no idea what I'm doing with this? Or do you have a sense that you know what you're doing?
I mean, I would generally say with translation, I have a more of a sense of control. I guess this might be a crutch for me. I'm one of those writers that really enjoys writing in form, and I think part of that is that I have this crutch. I know how many syllables this line has. I know that only words with this sound can go in this position. I've never been the kind, this is why I don't write fiction. I've never been the kind of person that can just spin stories off the top of his head. I actually went into writing with the expectation of becoming a nonfiction writer, having facts and figures and events already there before me to lie about. And it's the same with translation. I think A.E. Stalling said that, you know, with translation, you get to flex the same muscles as you would with your own poetry without writing your own poetry. And I think that's a big part of why I do it. I do enjoy writing poetry, but I don't think I've ever been too talented in coming up with my own And I guess I've just been blessed to come from this background where much of the literature has never been translated.
Yeah, I can't think, I hate to say it, I can't think of many Thai poetry books.
Right. There's not many out there. There's hardly any at all, and they're actually hard to get outside of Thailand. So it was my dream to actually make a niche for myself as a translator in that regard.
Yeah, I could see that. It'd make you kind of marketable. You know, as one of the, you know, one of the, if not only, one of the best Thai translators.
Well, it's easy to be the best when there's not many people doing it. That's what I'm counting on.
Especially when you kill the other three, you know?
Right.
That's how it is. So the question is, what made you move away from nonfiction?
You know, I never seem to be able to finish an essay and feel like this is ready, this I can send to an editor. I think especially essays tend to be a bit longer than your standard poem. And, you know, you get lost in, I think I get lost in the structure sometimes of keeping the momentum going over the course of a long narrative, and between setting and character, and then, you know, just having all your pieces in order. It's like, I think Anne Lamott says it's like putting an octopus to bed. Every time you think you have one arm down, another arm just pops up. And I've never quite felt comfortable with any longer pieces of nonfiction writing that I've done.
If you could tell one story, like, really well, if you were given the ability to tell one story really awesome from your life, what would you tell?
What would I tell? Gee, what have I written about? Very recently, I tried wrapping up an essay about... When I lived in Bangkok on the Fulbright, it was actually during the largest flood to hit Thailand in 50 years.
Okay, there's stories right there.
And I was living outside of Bangkok at the time, just slightly outside of Bangkok in the first suburb west. And, you know, I was really nonchalant about the whole thing. People were freaking out. The 7-Eleven across the street from me, they actually put a cement barrier up in front of their storefront. And I remember the day before my evacuation, I went in there and I said to the clerk, "Aren't you guys being a little paranoid?" And then I evacuated the next day because the waters came in.
I wonder what happened to those people at the 7-Eleven.
Oh, I'm sure they're fine. They built had the barrier up. I was the one that had to hightail it out of there because I was not prepared for it.
Protect the slushies.
Exactly. Protect. Well, you can get everything at Thai 7-Elevens. There's really one every block in Thailand. And you can get, you know, your standard 7-Eleven fare, but you can pay your phone bill. You can top up your caller minutes. You can pay your gas and water bill at 7-Elevens.
Why don't we have all service places like that? They say that they're convenience stores.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why can't they just be convenient for everything? Can I do my laundry at the Shell station?
No, you can't do your laundry at a Thai 7-Eleven, but you can do pretty much everything else there.
Then we really need to rethink our American 7-Elevens.
McDonald's here would probably be more viable because there's literally one everywhere.
Fair enough, but, you know, or some kind of thing. Like, if convenience, be really convenient, all right?
Right.
Allow me to pay my phone bill. Allow me to pay all my bills here.
Right. And even the 7-Elevens in Thailand, they're convenient in the sense that if you buy a frozen meal, they have a microwave for you to... And you don't do it. They will do it for you. They'll actually heat that frozen meal up for you and have the utensils for you to take out.
I was about to say, yeah, I think that's not uncommon to have the microwave there, but to have them be the ones to cook it for you? That's convenience.
That's convenience.
Here's a couch. Sit down for a couple minutes. You're tired. Thank you. That's very convenient of you.
I think the most convenient thing about American convenience stores is the availability of junk food, and that's about it.
Yeah, prepackaged, or, you know, you go to 7-Eleven and just look at the rotating hot dogs and taquitos.
Right.
And stare and be like, that is not a color found in nature.
Yeah, they're actually much better in Thailand, too. I don't know what it is. I could just be imagining it, but all that prepared food tends to be much better over there.
I don't know. You're selling me on going to Thailand now.
Hey, it is definitely cheaper to live there.
I wouldn't have a problem with that. Yeah, I was about to say, I'm willing to bet the countryside and the weather is just probably gorgeous. Because
mm-hmm.
We Americans were skewed on our view of it. About my introduction to Thailand was Street Fighter 2.
Oh, did that take place in Thailand? I never played video games growing up. I was one of those kids.
There's two boss fights that take place in Thailand.
Okay.
And so that was my only knowledge of it. That and seeing one time on ESPN Sepak Takraw.
Okay. The traditional kicking game.
Which I saw and I was like, what? This is amazing.
And for our listeners that don't know what Takraw is, it's a game similar to volleyball, but you can only use it's like volleyball and basketball at the same time, maybe more like basketball, but instead of your hands, you have to kick the ball up into the hoop with your feet or your knees or your chest or your head or your elbows. You can't use your hands.
And one of the moves, you know, American volleyball, you have the spike right up against the net. In this, you have a spinning kick that shoots this wicker ball that's only about 6-7 inches around at over 100 miles an hour at somebody's head.
I was just thinking, and all the time I was in Thailand, I've only seen people play Takraw a few times.
Well, I live in Florida, and I've never seen a highlight match.
Okay, that's fair then. I do think, though, it is a bit of a dying sport.
It just looks really cool to watch, and I sit there amazed watching it.
It does look really cool. I saw these boys playing on blacktop, you know, no shoes, and doing these flips right on the concrete or the asphalt. It was pretty impressive.
Then it must not be dying if the young are still playing it hardcore on the street.
Well, I think it was a certain community, certain economic background. Otherwise, some of these more chi-chi younger generation kids there. I mean, they don't tend to have much appreciation for their own culture, which is something that I find different from many other groups of people.
But now you're selling me today on Thailand. You know, it just sounds like it would be a cool place to visit.
It definitely is a cool place to visit. Living takes some getting used to, but there's a lot to appreciate there. A lot of drawbacks, but also a lot of benefits to living there.
If I was to go to Thailand, just out of the blue on vacation or anything, and I came to you for recommendations, what should I do? What would be some of your suggestions for where I should go, what I should do, what should I see?
Well, if you arrive in, most people would arrive in Bangkok, and Bangkok, you know, is the biggest city, it's the hub of Thailand, hub of mainland Southeast Asia still, really. Historic city, definitely the Grand Palace. It is the biggest tourist attraction, so it has the sort of Disney World quality to it now, where it's just lines and lines and lines of foreign tourists driving in on their multi-level buses. But it's something not to be missed. What I really liked about living in Bangkok, the Grand Palace stopped becoming a tourist attraction for me, and it just became the backdrop for my life. So seeing it every day and seeing it in different light and different weather, and it really became, like almost background scenery. I mean, I've always been big on Thai classical art and architecture, so I would really recommend the old temples and the murals and the National Museum. So I guess really standard tourist places. I think there's still value in them, even though they've become a little bit hackneyed as far as being on every tourist's itinerary. But they're there for a reason.
Are there any out-of-the-way places that non-touristy, like, you know, secret gems of Thailand that that someone like me should go to?
For those of you that go to Thailand in November, each year the Queen, for the past 5 years, the Queen has sponsored a production of classical Thai theater, but it's really the most outstanding show you can get in the country. And I was fortunate enough to work with some of the people behind the scenes where they're combining the classical theater with modern technology. So when the angels or demons fly, they're actually levitating across the stage. And all these old epics, there's a lot of magic in them. So they've incorporated some special effects. So when someone shoots an arrow and it turns into fire, there's actually some sort of special effect that goes along with it. In combination with the great costumes and the live music, it's definitely a show that I don't think many foreigners see.
Because they're afraid.
Well, it hasn't really been marketed to foreigners so much. It's every November for the past 5 years they've done this. And I mean, yeah, it is possible to order the tickets in you know, in English. And there are subtitles. They've started doing subtitles now, but I still think for the most part it's off the beaten tourist path. But it's a very, if you're in Thailand in November, you definitely need to see the Royal Theatrical production.
That sounds pretty awesome, actually. I'm a big fan of live theater. I would think that many tourists would be put off by that because, you know, you brought up the issue of subtitles, that, well, I don't know these stories, I don't know the language, so I'm not going to go.
Yes, I do think that's one barrier. It's one of the reasons I wanted to translate some of the texts of these epic stories that are produced in the theater. And the difficulty is compounded by the fact that there are mostly excerpts from the epic. You can't do the whole epic. You have to do excerpts from the epic. So you go in and the story rises and everyone already knows who the characters are, what the conflict is. And for a non-Thai person to go in, it could be very overwhelming.
But as you bring up, as we brought up, there's a universality to stories.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't necessarily need to know the basics. You know, like Joseph Campbell, the hero with a thousand faces.
Yes.
You know, you just mentioned part of one. I don't even know the story, but you say he shoots an arrow and it turns into fire. I'm thinking this person has to be a hero.
Yes.
Some type. And he is fighting a great evil.
Yes.
And, okay, the arrow turning into fire, well, normal arrow wouldn't cut it, so was the arrow blessed by somebody?
Yes, that's exactly it. And these stories have the same wellspring as a lot of those ancient Greek stories, kind of legacies of that Indo-European culture spreading all the way to Southeast Asia.
Speaking of the universality of stories, I get the impression that there is at least one saga that you're obsessed with.
One saga that I'm obsessed with.
And that would be the story of Usagi, Serena, a.k.a. Sailor Moon.
Clearly someone's been stalking my Facebook. Yes, 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 yes. I'm a huge Sailor Moon fan.
When did you get into it? I'm curious. What's your origin story?
I was in grade school, and you know it was on Cartoon Network, and I have always been attracted to... I've always been more attracted to what would traditionally be considered, you know, feminine concerns in literature or in film, or in this case in an animated cartoon, because I was never one of those boys that was very physical. So it used to be that if you watched anime, it was either there was just a few out at the time, and most of them were shonen. They were geared to young boys, so there's a lot of physical fighting, there's a lot of gratuitous violence, and I always thought that was so uncouth and not tasteful. And then you have the sailor soldiers who are being teenage girls. They actually shared more concerns with me just because I was always one of those boys. I was a little bit effeminate growing up. They were concerned about falling in love and keeping the right figure, and they fought evil in their school uniforms tastefully without this gratuitous violence, and I was hooked.
I got to ask, okay, so you watch it on Cartoon Network. Did you immediately, well, at the time, you're younger than me, so, and I remember what the scene was like back in the 90s. You couldn't really get many of the episodes, so when were you able to get more of the series and such?
Well, for the listeners that don't know the background of Sailor Moon, Sailor Moon is one of the biggest franchises, animated franchises to come out of Japan. Was very popular in the early 90s. It was dubbed into English by Deke. The company was called Deke, D-I-C, but it was heavily, and I never say this word correctly, bolderized, just censored. They only dubbed the first two seasons. So I remember just watching those first two seasons, and then this was when people started using the internet. And I remember the internet opening up a world to me where I realized, okay, Sailor Moon is really from Japan. There's many more episodes. The American version is highly censored. And for the longest time, I remember there used to be a website where I could read the summaries of each episode, how it happened originally. And then once with the advent of YouTube, then it became possible to actually watch all those episodes. And Now I won't watch it in English. I'll watch it with the Japanese subtitles.
Have you been paying attention to the new version that's up on Hulu? What is it, Sailor Moon Crystal?
Yes, I have. So it's the 25th anniversary of Sailor Moon, and to celebrate that, they've revitalized the franchise with an American corporation has redubbed it, uncensored, and you can watch all the original episodes subtitled on Hulu now, plus Sailor Moon Crystal, which is the reboot of the new season. Have you been watching it at all?
I'm going to be honest with you. I have actually never watched any.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Here's my secret that I seem to know a lot about it. My wife is a big fan, and I follow another podcast hosted by one of our former guests where they are watching and discussing each episode in sequence from the beginning.
What podcast is this?
It's called Sailor Business.
What? Okay, I need to find this. Who hosts this?
I can send you a link after we're off the air. I can put it up on our website for you.
Okay.
And it's a pretty popular one among a few friends of mine who are Sailor Moon fans, but I took a vow to never watch the show and just listen to their interpretations of everything.
Okay.
Without watching it. So to this day, I'm still convinced that they're up to like episode 13 now. I'm still convinced the guy who runs the arcade is always wearing a suit every time he appears.
You're conflating two characters, actually.
I know, but I gotta confess.
They've only gotten to episode 13. They don't know who the guy in the cape is, and they think it's the guy at the arcade, so that's why you're confused.
The people who are doing it, they know, because they're big fans, but the fact that the arcade manager comes out, his first appearance is in a suit. So from then on, I just always picture him coming out wearing a suit.
Well, you wouldn't be wrong. The one of the main protagonists, he dresses up in a tuxedo all the time.
And is pretty much a dick.
Well, yeah, but then he becomes a romantic lead, so.
But for the first whatever episodes, he's basically a dick to everyone, and they put forth the theory, the reason is, here's a 20-something-year-old man who hates himself that he's in love with a 14-year-old girl. And doesn't know why he likes her.
Yeah, you know, Sailor Moon started out as a comic book. And the age difference in the original comic is much smaller. She's 14, he's probably 18, which is pushing it, but still, okay, I get it. When they turned it into a cartoon, for whatever reason, she was still 14 and he was starting college. I have to say, Sailor Moon, when it came out, was very much ahead of its time as far as portrayals of sexuality. There were gay characters left and right, and, you know, this whole 14-year-old and maybe 20-year-old thing. And it was just part of the story, and I don't think anyone ever questioned it, except maybe these people at Sailor Business. they might have started raising some eyebrows.
Oh no, they're well aware of it, and you know, they're only up to episode 13, so Jupiter has not come into the story yet.
No.
None of the big planet ones yet.
Right. And I have to say, if they haven't talked about the new reboot yet, I'm actually very disappointed with the new season.
You're disappointed. Why are you disappointed with it?
They're really just adapting it directly from the original comic this time, which is not to say that's bad necessarily, but I don't know, it almost seems like a lazy adaptation.
There's something missing?
Yeah, there's something missing. There's no room for character development. Some of the new episodes, if you compare it to the original comic, it's like frame by frame by frame, same dialogue as well, just transferred onto the screen. And I don't know, it doesn't have the same charm as the original 90s series had. The original 90s series had, you know, some subplots going on, and there was always a lot of gags and a lot of gag humor. And there's none of that silliness, goofiness going on in the new season. They're really just by the book, literally, adapting the series.
So it feels like some of the charm of the silliness, the translation issues are lost.
Yes.
It's too by the book.
It's too by the book. I never thought of it that way. Maybe it's too accurate.
That it feels almost kind of sterile in a way.
It does feel very sterile. That's the best word for the new series. It's very sterile.
Well, it's good, but where's a goofy, stupid moment like throwing in a PSA at the end of the episode?
No, that was something completely done by Deke, the American dubbers of Sailor Moon. And ironically, the footage that they would use for those PSAs was actually taken from footage they cut out, censored from the episode itself many of the times.
And I take it then that you're still a big fan.
Oh, I'm still a huge fan. I can't wait for tomorrow. The new episode comes out, Sailor Moon Crystal.
So what's the appeal of it as you get older? Like, what keeps it fresh for you?
What keeps it fresh for me? Does it go back to the idea of universality of stories? I don't know. I just find the stories so appealing. And I think it's because I do tend to relate to female characters and traditionally feminine concerns in art and literature. These are a group of girls who are, you know, they're middle school girls, and they're fighting crime in their school uniforms and trying to keep, you know, get good grades, stay in shape, be pretty. And I just find that there's a lot of me in those characters.
Something that's been brought up before about the show is that in a lot of cartoons, especially Western, young girls who watch cartoons can only relate to the one female character. They have to project their personality onto the one female.
Uh-huh.
And what makes Sailor Moon appealing is that they give you a variety of girls.
There's a variety of girls, yes. There's, you know, there's your I guess, more stock girl cartoon characters. But, you know, Sailor Mars, her civilian aspect, her name is Rei, and she's kind of a misandrist. She's not attracted to men. I mean, I don't mean that in a sexual sense, but she's very independent and mistrustful of men. And it's revealed that she had some formulative experiences with men that made her distrust them. So it's not like there's many different role models to pick from in this series.
Yeah, trying to get a beat on it from my wife. I'm like, so give me a heads up here. So Saturn is kind of like a goth girl in a way. She's like, Yeah, kind of, sort of. So it gives, but it gives viewers a variety that they can project themselves onto and go, well, I'm more this one.
Right.
So now I got to ask you, who's your favorite?
I think I'm more of a Mars. I guess I'm kind of a misandrist myself. I don't know. I did dabble in divination and fortune telling once upon a time. Though I'm not nearly as assertive or as loud. I guess I'm kind of a Mars-Mercury mix in the series. You know quite a bit about the series for not actually having watched it.
Yeah, this is what I get for listening to it on a weekly basis and learning. And having a wife who is very well-schooled in it.
Is she watching the reboot?
I don't know when she finds the time to do anything right now with her job and her work right now. So, but she is able to go through. In fact, we're on the phone. We often debrief about the episode so I can get questions answered. And she went through, well, here's what happens in the next 3-4 seasons. Let me explain how this all goes so that you have an understanding, you know.
Can I meet your wife?
She's pretty. I'll be honest with you. I confess I am not a huge anime fan at all. It's just not my thing. But,
and you know, I'm actually not a huge anime fan either. I really don't watch anything else.
There are really no other television that you watch?
I don't really watch much television, no. I'm not one of those people that will make time to watch shows. I'll make time to watch Sailor Moon when it comes out every other Saturday. But I'm not the kind of person that says, oh, tonight is Tuesday, which means I have to watch. I have no idea what's on a Tuesday. I do like to watch a lot of real crime, though.
Like, I go out into the street and I just watch real crime.
Yes, I like to dress in my school uniform and go fight crime on Tuesdays.
That's my Tuesday activity.
Yes.
Dress up in my teaching outfit and I go fight crime.
That would be an awesome comic/anime series. I want a story about a struggling English adjunct who teaches class by day, tries to get published by day, and then at night he fights crime in a tweed blazer, and he calls himself the Agent of Love and Literacy.
I am the professor.
Yes, the professor.
And he has a pipe so that, and he, you know, and he blows like smoke and turns into fog.
You really have been debriefing yourself about the season or about the characters.
Yeah, I can come up with just ideas here for this. Actually, I want to get into it. If I was ever a wrestling manager, that would be my gimmick. I would be the professor.
I can see a future in that.
My man here, he is the bronze, I am the brain. Together, we will take on this league by storm.
You get an F.
You get an
F-U, a big F-U.
You get an F, and you get an A in pain.
You definitely have the voice down. I can see why you do radio.
Yeah. I think it's also the cold that I'm just getting over, still affecting the voice.
Uh-huh. I hear ya. I'm getting more stuffed up, actually.
Oh, man. I'm destroying you right now.
Oh, no.
I'm infecting you with my germs digitally.
You know, someday we might be able to do that.
I hope not. It's hard enough. It's hard enough being a teacher.
Yeah, it definitely is hard enough to being a teacher. Well, someday we'll probably be teaching as holograms anyways.
For now, we have to deal with the student who comes to school with 102-degree fever and is like, but I don't want to get an absence. And you're just like, go home now.
You made me come here, but on your attendance policy, don't look at the syllabus. I don't care what the syllabus says. Go home.
Look, anything above 98.6, or actually anything above 99, go home. Now.
Though actually, most of my students have been pretty resilient this semester. I think I might have caught this on my own.
Blame it on them anyway.
Yeah, I should blame it on them anyway. They've weakened my body's ability to react to disease.
It's all the grading. I'm stressed out, therefore I can't fight off infection.
You know, I kind of cheat with the grading. I don't tend to give them that much homework because I just can't keep up with the grading.
It sucks, too. If you get sick, you fall behind on what you do have.
When they have presentations, I actually make them read them. Or I'm sorry, when they have essays, I make them read them in class. It makes it easier to grade afterwards because I've already heard it once and I generally know what they deserve.
There's an art to teaching, and I don't want to talk too much about that because I don't want to. I know a couple of my formers listen to this, and I don't want to reveal all my secrets.
Yeah, I'm not expecting any of my students to hear this, so. Now, university administrators, colleagues, maybe. So maybe you might want to do some fine editing. I'll let that up to your, leave that up to your discretion.
No, you've been pretty good so far. It's, you haven't said anything too dangerous.
I don't need FERPA on my door.
No.
FERPA and the Fulbright Committee.
Hey, for all I know, we talked at the beginning of the episode here, writers lie.
Writers,
so for all I know, you lied about that.
Oh yeah, I'm lying about everything right now. None of this is true.
Yeah. For all I know, 70 to 80% of everything I write is a lie.
Right, exactly. Now, I said the opposite, but...
You might have been lying about that, though.
Yeah, I could have been.
Yeah. You could be lying. It could be Sailor Neptune is your favorite, for all we know.
Could be. I do love my Sailor Neptune.
I don't even know what she looks like.
She has,
I can't tell them apart, honestly.
She has wavy green hair.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
And she plays the violin.
I'll take your word. I did cheat, though. I will say I did cheat. I did watch one clip, because okay. After it was discussed, I had to go look it up.
What was the clip?
It's in one of the early episodes where Sailor Moon's family is watching a show, and the guys act on television. It's the talent show episode where the monkey, and the translation is the guy tells his pet monkey, act sorry. And I had to go look up the clip because there's something about a sad monkey that just made me lose it.
None of this is ringing a bell. Monkey. I know there's a few episodes where there's theater involved, but
that's an early one where Jedi tries to put on talent show and steal everybody.
So. Okay. I know which one you're talking about, but I don't recall there being a monkey in that episode.
There is a monkey in the background. And So I lost it hearing about that. I don't know. There's something about monkeys that I find hilarious. Always have.
That's the episode called Usagi Will Teach You The Road to Stardom Is Tough. Or something along those lines.
I'll take your word for it.
It must have been episode 6, 5?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm dealing with a real fan here.
Yeah.
I can't fake it. Damn.
Well, let me know if your wife ever wants to attend a Sailor Moon retreat with me.
I would not be surprised that those things exist.
I've actually never been to one, but I assume they exist.
What would you do at a Sailor Moon retreat?
You would dress up as your favorite character and carry a wand.
Okay. You know, come up with new ways to challenge evil.
Yes, of course.
I mean,
that's what I do every day when I walk into the classroom.
Stand back, citizens. I've got this. And now, the verb tense.
Oh, the verb tenses. Those pesky verb tenses must be punished.
There are only three. Well, no, actually, there's like, what, 12 in English?
I think there's 12 as a standard number. I don't teach grammar. It is not my role to teach grammar.
Do you enjoy teaching grammar?
No, not at all.
I can't name any college professor who does.
Well, I'll teach it when it comes up. The way my program is set up, I teach reading and writing. There's a grammar teacher and then a listening speaking teacher, and they overlap. They have to overlap, and I will only do it as it comes up.
My philosophy is that, you know, I teach grammar, but I don't do, like, weekly lessons in it.
No, I can't do weekly lessons in it.
And my philosophy is, at this point, you should know how to write. I'm here to teach you to communicate.
Right. but that's also the luxury of having native English speakers for the most part.
I recognize that, yeah. We are almost out of time. I just happened to look at the clock, and I'm like, what the? Before we go, though, I heard today that you got some new work coming out.
I do have some new work coming out. Okay, now my verb tenses are all over the place now. Okay, you can edit that out. I do have work coming out. I will be published in Lunch Ticket coming up very soon, I think. The Raintown Review, and then a British-based journal, Structo.
It's a good name for a journal.
It is a great name for a journal. I was very happy to make it in there.
Structo.
Yes. I didn't even consider it that way. Destructo, I guess.
That sounds like a cartoon character right there. I am Structo.
Structo.
There you go. That's the adjunct professor's name. It's short for instructor.
Oh, I never even considered that. You know, you're really good at this. Are you sure you don't want to produce your own anime?
I don't know if I'd be good at anime. I thought about going into comic book writing originally, but then I realized I can't take it seriously.
No? Well, you do political shorts then.
Okay, yeah, I could do that maybe. We're just, I don't know. I'm happy doing what I do. But anyway, so before we go though, the folks at home, where can they find you on the internet?
Where can they find me on the internet? I mean, I do have a Facebook account, but my blog is not currently up yet. I intend to get it up in the next few weeks before my Lunch Ticket publication goes online.
Well, let us know when you do, and we will post the link to that and spread it around for folks.
That would be amazing. I would really appreciate that.
No problem. Just keep us in touch, man. No, it has been great talking to you.
It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for coming on. It's been a pleasure, man.
Thanks for having me.
So we hope to hear from you soon, man.
Thank you.
All right. Take care of yourself.
Take care. I'll talk to you later.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.